Good morning, everyone. Beautiful day. I'll be up in the crisp air of Armidale. Certainly a beautiful place. And thank you for all the breakfast staff and everyone who made everything happen this morning. And thanks too to the musicians and Bruce for his lovely prayer that really brought us to God. And thanks to Jake too for his reading. This morning, I want to look at the things, where we're going is the things that actually create us. And particularly in regard to, I suppose you would say, our family background in a sense, but what that contributes and what we can do to build a family background for our own children that will really build something, that will really carry something for our own children, our own families, our own grandchildren. Where this came from particularly was I'm doing this study of David, and as I'm doing this study, I'm realizing that David is not getting a lot of mention at first. In fact, what I'm hearing a lot about is Jesse, and his name keeps coming up, his father's name. And it was a name, a family name, if you like, that it seemed to polarize people. You're either on one side of it or the other. And I read language like this, if I can just go through a few of the quotes. And this is what I'm reading. I'm looking for David, but I'm hearing these expressions. And I'm hearing this, on one side, I hear this family reputation almost of a political threat. 1 Samuel 20, verse 30, Saul said to Jonathan, I'll just run through these, don't turn them up. You have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame. In 1 Samuel 22, verse 8, Saul says to Jonathan, you're in league. David says to the men around him, not David, Saul rather, in his frustration at not being able to catch David, he decides in his mental state that everyone was conspiring against him. He's starting working on this conspiracy theory that all his men are out to get him. And he says, who is it who's in a league with a son of Jesse? And then you remember Doeg the Edomite, he puts up his hand and he says, well, I saw the son of Jesse come to Abimelech and he took the big sword of Goliath. Nabal, who David had worked so hard to protect all his men, said, who is the son of Jesse? And you remember later in David's life, after the drama that he had with Absalom, in 1 Samuel 25, verse 1, Sheba the son of Bichri hops up when everything was nearly all sorted out and says, we have no part in Jesse's son. Let's out of here. And everyone took off. So you got the use of that language on that side. And then on the other side, you've got this lovely language. It's called the rallying place of peace. In Isaiah 11, verse 1 to 2, a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. The Spirit of God will rest on him. In Isaiah 11, verse 10, in that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner, an international rallying place. In Acts chapter 13, verse 22, we read the words there that David was found the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart. And in Romans 15, verse 12, we're told that the root of Jesse would arise and in him the Gentiles would trust. And when I put all that sort of language together, I start to realize what I'm talking about David so much as what's been emphasized is a family culture. Because I'm just hearing that so much. Now, there's a big battle on, and it's been pretty extended, and it's been going on a long time. And a standoff where suddenly there was a breakthrough in the battle. And one side chases the other for miles and miles and miles. Those guys chase each other all day, and then they marched all night back. And after this big battle was over, that all he had this huge standoff with it, one of the officers of 30 or 40 men, he came back to his tent and he had blood on him. He was puffing. He was half dead. But he was feeling good. But he knew when he got back to that tent, that when he got back there, their supplies had just about run out. He was so tired. And he drags himself back to the tent, dragging his spear behind him, sort of happy, but after thinking, oh, he's hungry as a bear. He's had nothing to eat. And he goes, oh. And he goes down and he gets inside his tent and he grabs his little stool and he sits down. He drinks the last of the swig of his water bottle. It is water, I promise Brother Dick Hillhouse it is. He's the policeman of our meeting. And he goes, what's this here? He sees it on this table and he... Whoops. What is this? And he looks at it and he goes, oh, that's cheese. Cream cheeses. Where'd that come from? Just what I need. Gets the cheese out. How do you open cheese? Anyone else want a cream cheese? Brother Bruce? He gets it out. Sorry? He probably did. He was using his battle knife. There we go. And he goes, oh, wow, look at that. Hang on. That's for you, Bruce. I don't want you fading away to a shadow. And he sits down. He goes, whoa. Oh, man. Where'd that come from? Says to one of his men, who put these cheeses here? I don't know. Now someone did this, tell them, come and have some. Oh, they're good cheese too. Oh, that feels better. Oh, that's great. Where did they come from? One of his men says, oh, I saw that young fella, Jesse's son, he dropped them in there. He goes, Jesse's, what, Eliab's little brother, wasn't he the guy that... And he goes, whoa, you're telling me before he went out and slew that giant, he delivered a little present of cream cheeses to me? And I'm sitting there, I was not doing much, was I? And he looks at these cream cheese presents of 10 cream cheeses, as 1 Samuel 17 says, and he just shakes his head and he thinks, wow, that is amazing. That is that kid who went out and did that stuff. I'm sitting here eating his cream cheeses from his dad. And I see that little story put as an introduction to the story of David and Goliath. And I didn't want to talk about David and Goliath. I'm pretty sure you know that story this morning. But that story, I just love the way a storyteller tells a story in the Bible, because it's as though the way the storyteller tells a story is actually trying to give us a message. What built up to that scene? What built up to the bravery and the drama that got that kid where he was, that brought about that victory that day? And I'm reading here this foundation story behind it, that in fact there's something about the family stamp of this son of Jesse, this Jesse family stamp, that actually led to that event of that slaying of that giant. And when I think about what it was, as the Bible portrays it, as a storyteller tells it, what I'm being told is to slay giants is absolutely critical to be able to make cream cheeses. Now, is there any cheesemakers here? There isn't. Dick makes a little cordial. He reckons I'm going to make the cheese so that we can have a little chat later. So he makes a lovely cordial and I make the cheese, and we all get on quite well down there at Wanji and Toronto there. But look, I mean, when you do this handmade stuff, there's quite an effort in it. And you put it together. Now, just turn to this quote here for a moment, if you can, in 1 Samuel 16 and verse 19, which is just back a little bit. And I think what you're looking at here is little independent stories. There's stories put together by different storytellers at different times. They're little oral stories, and they're all put together in one big long story, apparently, in Samuel. And they don't all quite line up. Don't worry about that. They all had to be little standalone stories with their own beginning and their own end. And the beginnings and ends don't all, like introductions, who've met what, whom, don't quite meet up so well all the time. That doesn't matter. That's just how the Bible got put together, as all these little stories were grouped together because they're personal witnesses and people saw things differently at different times. When it's all run together as Englishmen, and we tend to look at it and say, well, this isn't quite lining up as rocket science. Just don't worry about that. Think of this as a completely independent little story. Verse 19 of 1 Samuel 16. This is when Saul realized that if he had David there with him, it would calm his mental state down, because he would get obsessed with things, and he would start believing these conspiracy theories, and he was on the edge mentally all the time. And in verse 19, so Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, "Send me your son David, who is with the sheep." So he just gets this message to send David, because David's going to go over and play the harp and calm him down and settle his nerves down. Could you send him over? So Jesse does that, but here's just this little bit that's put in here. So Jesse took a donkey loaded with bread, a skin of wine, and a young goat, and sent them with David, his son. David came to Saul and entered his service, and Saul liked him very much. So it's just that little addition, if you like, in verse 20. Here's the king of Israel, and yet Jesse, when he sends David over to him, also loads up this donkey with bread, a skin of wine, and a young goat, like the king actually needed that. But what I'm seeing in this language here, I'm seeing a family stamp, and I'm trying to build a picture, if you like, of what this family stamp looks like. But I can see in this family stamp, whoops, that it's like, here's this family stamp of Jesse. And you can see from these 10 cream cheeses up here that these people of, if you like, this, what would you call them? They're service-oriented people. And when you think about service-oriented people, I guess you can think of people like this in your own meeting. And I look at them and they just amaze me. And yet it was a family stamp, wasn't it? Because look, with that family stamp, whether he's giving out cream cheeses, whether he's sending his son on a donkey to, how do you draw donkeys, to the king, that's supposed to be a donkey, and he's sending him off to the king, and he's still loading that up with wine and bread, and off he goes to the king. Whatever he's doing, whether it's a loser commander of 30 in the army, or whether he's sending it to the king, Jesse is not there saying, well, you know, should I send this little gift to this guy? That's the commander of 30. I mean, he's been standing there for 40 days going nowhere. It was almost like this unconditional giving, wasn't it? And I see in that unconditional giving, I see people like this in our churches, in our ecclesial life, if you like. They're just givers. And you see some old people just been doing that giving all their life. And if this is a family stamp, you'll probably remember back to Boaz, who in a time when everyone did that which was right in his own eyes, he used to get up there and address his reapers every morning, didn't he? And he'd say, "Blessed be you of the Lord." And they'd say back to Boaz, "Blessed be you of the Lord." And off they go to work, and in the middle of the day come in and make sure they all had a feed and they're all looked after. And of course, when Ruth comes into that scene, she comes into a pretty natural scene where he says, just make sure that girl gets looked after, he says, and the young men, you know, don't say anything rude to her, and that she gets fed over there. And it was just what they did, if you like, as a family stamp. But what starts to happen is, in this unconditional service-oriented way, you get in this, you get what's happening is building up. You build up, I suppose, this cell of strength. And if you look at how life runs and how spiritual life runs and our church life runs over the years, it strikes me that it's often little cells of strength here and little cells of strength there of these sort of people that actually hold the thing going through many ups and downs, through many mood changes, through many different ways of doing things. It seems to me that there's just these little family groups, if you like, here and there that actually just keep carrying it irrespective, and they serve anyway. I just love to see these people, especially ones who just go giving out cream cheeses like this. I mean, you must be able to think of people like this in your own meeting. I'm sure there's a bunch of people here like this now. I mean, it's just interesting to me, because all they had to do was prepare the cream cheeses. You know, all David had to do was bring his gift. And like, it's almost like his gift prepared the way for him. He went there to bring a gift of cheese and say good day to his brothers, but God had him there for a different reason that David didn't know about. God does that for us. We think we're going here for hit that. But when we arrive there, we finally have to end up talking to someone, and actually you realize that God actually brought you there that day for something totally different than you thought you were there for. But all we've got to concentrate on is developing our gift. The gift will bring us places. We don't have to go and try and make a path for ourselves and create things and make things happen. We just got to concentrate on making the gift, and the gift will bring us before great people. Oh, I was at a little do. It was at mental blank when you're giving a talk. I'm looking at them down in the audience in orange. The Whedon's place. And we had a little do with the Ignite group there that day. There's a bunch of people there for a barbecue. And look, it was a barbecue and it was going well until we got sort of called the way through the night, and someone had got this fire going. It's a particularly cold night. And there's this young brother, and I won't mention your name, he's on tape, but look, you must know these sort of people in your own groups. And you know, we're all sitting around having a nice time, drinking away, eating and talking and really enjoying this little fire, which we could all see going down. Now, if you've ever gone down the back of the Whedon's place, it's like the Lion's Den down the back of it there as it goes down into, oh, it must be lost in the Belmont Beach there somewhere or other. But I hear this crashing around down there. And here is this brother, and he's down there in the dark without a torch, and he's dragging logs up. Now, there's no way I'd lift a log up in the Australian bush at night ever. But he was, and he's dragging these logs up, throwing them on the fire and building this fire up. And I just look at him and I think, wow, look at that. And then you see him somewhere else and he's so helpful. It's embarrassing. And sometimes you try and help him and you just can't keep up with him. Or he looks at you and smiles at you and says, look, it's okay, it's okay. And just the way he smiles at you, you sort of don't even try to keep up with him. And what surprises me is, these sort of people, what we're being told and what we see as this story develops is, because it's just not this, but what happens is that when you get this little cells of strength, what starts to happen in these things as we follow this around here, we start to get little private miracles. Now I'll show you one. Start to happen in their life. Now I'll show you one. If we look there in 1 Samuel 17 and verse 32, David said to Saul, let no one 1 Samuel 17, verse 32, let no one lose heart on account of the Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him. Saul replied, verse 33, you're not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You're a little more than a boy, and he's been a warrior from his youth. But David said to Saul, now, I'm going to suggest to you, as the storyteller tells this story's never been told before. And there's only two people listening to it now, and it's Saul and Abner. Now, I just want you to try and pick up the sense of privacy about the story. And he says in verse 34, but David said to Saul, your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. Now, this is a convincing enough story to make the king of Israel agree to something that otherwise would be ludicrous. And he says, and a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock. And look what it says. Follow the language here, phrase by phrase. Verse 35, I went after it. I struck it. Number three, I rescued the sheep from its mouth. Number four, when it turned on me, I seized it by the hair. And you can almost feel that hair with the fleas and the lion jumping off around his nails, can't you? Grab it by the hair. And Saul would have looked at him and was like, this guy's for real. And I struck it. I killed it. And he quietly says, your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. Whoa. Those bears are powerful critters. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he's defied the armies of the living God. And you know what I think when I read that? I think this. When did David first work out that he could kill a bear before he took it on? Because the way that reads is the bear came, he took the lamb. Well, I forget the numbers I was telling you there. He went and he rescued the lamb. That's all he's thinking about. Then suddenly he realizes a bear on him who turns around and he goes for him. And David says, I struck him. And then I killed him. As that reads, I'm saying, as the storyteller tells that story, I'm reading that he found that out accidentally. Because all he was interested in was saving that sheep. And said, it turned on me. Whoa. So I grabbed it by the hair and I struck it and killed it. As that reads, it was an accidental discovery. You see what I'm saying there? Because what leads to these private miracles taking place? Well, all we can see leading to it is a family background of unconditional forgiving, of being service-oriented in a very practical and hands-on way, whether those in leadership in the church were running the show well or not. It just gave right back from Boaz's time. Things weren't working very well in Boaz's time. Jesse was considered an old man in Saul's time. We read that this morning, didn't we? Jake read that for us this morning. So things were pretty tough then. And here they were. They just gave anyway. They just gave. And private miracles like that start to happen. And that was very convincing to Saul. And, you know, I wonder whether Jonathan was in on that conversation, because he would have been thinking, wow, about the time he was doing that, I was scaling that cliff with the Philistines with one other very little private miracle that no one else saw bar an armor bearer. And it's almost like God is saying here that if you just concentrate on your gift and your unconditional giving, irrespective of the circumstances, I'll start to work little miracles in the lives of people like that. Now, Psalm 8 is a... what's the superscription saying? Muth Laban, the death of the champion. You don't have to turn it up, but Psalm 8, the death of the champion. As David is going down to kill Goliath, now I know what I'd be thinking, but as he's going down, he's writing a little psalm. He's writing poetry. And in Psalm 8, to me is he walks down writing this little bit of poetry and he stops at the creek and he picks up five stones. And the storyteller almost brings us into a little private moment, five little stones. And I think it's the 144th Psalm. He writes another psalm about this and he says, God, you're teaching my fingers to walk. Teach my fingers to walk. Teach my fingers to walk. Now, here was a man the night before in Psalm 8, the night before he was counting, he was trying to teach his fingers to walk. The night before he was doing two things, the Bible says. Psalm 8 says one of them. Can remember, don't turn it up. Psalm 8, what was he doing the night before he killed Goliath? Can you remember Psalm 8 when I consider? What was he doing? He was stargazing. That was what he was doing. He was in a very pensive mood and he was looking at me saying, wow, look at that. Look at you, Father. Look at us. What do you care about us for? That's it. And then there was something else he had to attend to. What was it? I took you from feeding the sheep, from following the, I'm quoting the old King James Version that my mother thrashed into me. From following the, what did God take David from to make him, and I made you ruler over my people. What's that bit there? I took you from feeding the sheep, from following the, that's it. He was, the night before, he was following along, shepherding along this group of heavily pregnant ewes, probably attending to a difficult lambing the night before. That's David for you, stargazing up there, attending to a difficult lambing here. And he puts it all in the same Psalms as he writes, teach my fingers to walk, teach my fingers to walk. To me, that's amazing that we have a mind up there and we attend to difficult lambings here. And when you do that service-oriented sort of stuff in your life in an unconditional way, these private little miracles start to take place. And I suggest the picking up of the five stones is where David's fingers learnt to war. And he was able to get up and go, and knock the giant down, as we know how the story runs. Now, you couple that with another aspect to this, and that is the small town, if you like, humility that comes with that. Small town humility. David, later they said to David, you know, you ought to be the king's son-in-law. And he says, hang on a second, I'm just from a little town. You just don't become the king's son-in-law for those reasons. And that makes me think of another quote. Don't turn to it. I'm going to ask you what it is. But I think it's Micah. I'll get it in a minute. Micah 4, verse 2. But I'll get to that in a second. Please don't turn up on one of those zippy-zappy computer things that they use these days either. But I guess what we're saying here is that this family culture brings these private miracles out. And we look at the things where we like our kids to go. We look at the things where we like our church to go and where it should be. And often we dream up quite fancy things and want to drive things along and push this and push that. And yet we're learning here that, look, just keep making cream cheeses. Just keep serving generation in, generation out. Keep serving whatever aspect is happening in your church, in your ecclesia. Just keep serving. And your gift of the cream cheeses is going to prepare the path for that thing that you want to do. And it also does something else. It also gives, if you like, a inner moral fiber. Let me just show you one more story. You've got to have a look at this. It's, hang on a sec. I just want to link this in so you can see how this one works. It's 1 Samuel 24. Can we just flick over to it? You know this story here where David, verse 1, where David's in the desert of En-Gedi, and verse 2, Saul took 3,000 able young men from Israel and set out for David and his men near the crags, the wild goats, and verse 3, come to the sheep pens along the way, and there's a cave there. I'm not sure if there's maybe some people who are new to the Bible and sort of aren't fully familiar with some of these stories. I don't want to flick through it too quick. And as it turns out, Saul, verse 3, came to the sheep pens along the way, and there was a cave there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. So old David's been chased down by Saul, and they're going through this labyrinth of caves down in the desert, and they're just nearly crisscrossing each other. They don't know that David's men are actually inside the cave. Saul decides to go in there, it says, to relieve himself. And David is there with 400 crazy men. And they're in the dark of that cave. And Saul, of course, is completely vulnerable. And it says there in verse 4, the men said, this is a day that the Lord spoke of when he said, I'll give your enemies into your hands for you to deal with as you wish. Then David crept up unnoticed and cut off the corner of Saul's robe. Now, that's a very quick little story if you haven't heard that one before. But basically, what is going on there, Saul comes in and he sort of, I won't illustrate, but he crouches down to do what he has to do. And I guess to do that, first he took off his robe and he chucked it over there and it's dead dark. What he doesn't know is that there's 400 or 500, or I think it was 600, was it? I'm not good on numbers, but that men in the sides of the cave and they're moving back like this and all got their hand on their sword like this. And they're all around this cave, and those guys, they knew how to fight. Every one of them was an SAS fighter, these guys, and they knew how to move around without making a single noise. And there they are, and Saul is right there, and he's doing what he's doing. And these men are like this. And David and his men start having this conversation, and it goes like this. Now, I know it's written there in words, but this is how it went. It went, what? And another man over there said, there's David there. Which meant this is a day that the Lord has delivered him into your hands. This guy over here is saying, here's your opportunity. This guy over here is saying, he's quoting the Bible. He's quoting the Bible, doesn't he? This is very, very appealing, this. He says there in verse 4, the men said, this is the day the Lord spoke of whom he said to you, I'll give your enemies into your hands, quote, for you to deal with as you wish. I'm not sure that last bit's a quote, but that's certainly how he quoted it. And this is what's happening. And David is there. What's making David make the moral decisions that David makes? And David, it says, he rebuked his men strongly. Now, I don't know how you do that when Saul is down there going, whatever Saul's doing. And he's down there doing that. And David goes to his men, he goes, he's got it. He rebukes them strongly. It went like this. Now, you're trying to rebuke 600 men who have got the cause of all their problem, very easy solution. And he goes, they see him move up there. And he goes, puts it back. That was a big silent argument. That, and Saul gets up and he goes out, and all the men look at him. What did you do, David? David goes outside the cave. Saul's about 200 yards away, and he calls out, Saul! And said, Saul recognized his voice, which is pretty sad. Saul recognized his voice. He swings around. He says, my son, David. And David says, you're missing something, Saul. I think this is possibly a piece of your garment. And I cut it off. And Saul goes, whoa! I was just in the and it goes through his head like this. But here's the bit, as we tell that story. In the drama and the tension of that, sometimes we have to make decisions in life. And how you make that decision, sometimes you haven't got a lot of time to make it. And it's a decision that may affect things that go on in a lot of ways the rest of your life. Sometimes life is just like that. Maybe it's not fair, maybe it shouldn't be, but that's just how it is sometimes. Now, what did David fall back on so that the circumstances, the extenuating circumstance of his life would be not instead of be, would 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 become the moral exercise instead of the excuse. We're always quoting extenuating circumstances as an excuse. David only quoted extenuating circumstances as a moral exercise. What held it together? And what he does is he quotes something to Saul and says, I didn't touch you, Saul, because, I want you to just whiz over, this is a verse I'm actually trying to get to, which is verse 13. As the old saying goes, were you with me in verse 13? I'll read verse 12, but may the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will not touch you. Verse 13, I love this verse. He says, as the old saying goes, from evildoers come evil deeds, so my hand will not touch you. Now, I think the old King James Version says, as saith the proverb of the ancients, wickedness proceedeth from the wicked, but my hand shall not be against you. Anyone reading from the old King Jamesy? Oh, an O'Toole family tradition, is it? I doubt he is. That's what it says. You are? Is that what it says? Pretty much. Don't start. Read it to me, Liz. Upon thee. Oh, upon, against, upon. Okay. Wickedness proceedeth from the wicked, but my hand shall not be upon thee. So give me the quote. What did he say in the old King James? What were the words that this ancient proverb, the proverb of the ancients, says that, doesn't it? Proverb of the ancients? Give me the proverb. Just call the proverb out. That's it. Oh, I love this in Scripture. How many words is that? I'm not good at math. Wickedness proceedeth from the wicked. That's five. In Hebrew, it's probably three. I don't know. Those five words are essentially what stopped David acting foolishly on that occasion, even when the Bible was being quoted, Scripture was being quoted, the prophets were being quoted, and logic was being quoted, and he fell back on something else. Now, I love that old King James language. As saith the proverb of the ancients. That says to me, this proverb was used by Jesse's dad, Boaz's dad, dad's until they get to however old guys be when they become ancient in your memory. And that proverb came all the way down and served them all in their life, and it worked. And as a family culture, a family stamp, they did two things. They had that as a philosophy of life, and they gave out cream cheeses. Now, what does that proverb actually say in real life words? What's it say in Aussie language today? What's it mean? What does it mean? Wickedness proceedeth from the wicked. Yeah, bad stuff comes from bad people. Keep it.
One word.
Sorry?
One word.
Yeah, give me one word.
Karma.
What goes around comes around. Is that what you're saying? What goes around comes around. And I'm not getting involved in your cycle of violence. The moment I acted against you, I'd have got dragged into your rubbish. And we're not going there. Now, you know, we live in a life and we live in a times when it's so easy to live in this reactionary or reactive, is that the word? I don't know if I'm using the right word, way. Someone says something against you or does something against you, you go, oh, and off you go and react. Something else bad happens, you go, oh, woe is me, and you react to that. And we go around in life getting blown this way. I just need a drink. This way and then that way over everything that happens. And David, as a family culture, had learnt they had to stand back and stop getting blown around and reacting to everything and stand back and say, I'm not going to get involved in that cycle of overreacting to everything, hitting back, reacting, getting drawn into stuff. And as a family, they'd learnt It doesn't work. It's just madness. And everything else, even Bible quotes were being used to justify that. Logic was being used. Any reasonable person could see this is your opportunity. And he rejected all that and he fell back on a family culture, which in this case was the correct thing to do. Now, what I'm trying to do is link up giving out cream cheeses, moral fiber, private miracles, and added to that the small town Bethlehemite existence. Now, you didn't turn up Micah 4, did you? Because you're going to do this from memory. What's it say? Is it Micah 4 verse 2? I probably got the quote long. I'll start it for you. Oh, someone know it? Don't turn it up. If you call it out and you turn it up, that's cheating. Does anyone know what it says? Oh, I think everyone knows. Thanks. I recognize that voice. Yeah, how little you are, though thou, I'm quoting my mum's version, though thou be little among the thousands, and thou Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judea, yet out of thee shall come he whose goings forth have been old from everlasting. Who is it talking about? Jesus Christ, wasn't it? And the only thing it said to think about that produced him was, come from a little town. Had this small town humility. This something, this man was something God was going to create. I'm going to introduce Jesus Christ to you. Comes from a little town called Urella, down the road there. You know, picture Thunderbolt, a few other things, not much else. Bit of a bakery that, you know, you chew on stuff and it's okay. That's my introduction. Because when you link this stuff, this unconditional forgiving, the realization of the cell of strength, the moral fiber of that family background, the private miracles that start to happen, you add that to small-time humility, and what you got is the son of Jesse. And that son of Jesse became a polarizing thing. It was a fearful thing for the enemies, for his political enemies, if you like, but it was a powerful thing for the Gentiles. It was a powerful thing for us. It was a rallying place of peace. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. The Spirit of God will rest on him. In that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner, an international rallying place. So I suppose the exhortation is this. If we want to go great places, all we got to do is concentrate on our gift. Your gift will take you to great places. You want to do great things. We want to build a great community. Concentrate on our gift. And when you look at the gift, it is so much that gift that is built around us, giving despite the circumstances, building your family and how we can do this. And to think of the things that you bring even into a marriage or into relationships, which are just you bringing your family stuff in and trying to sort your family stuff through. That's how churches work. That's how ecclesias work. We bring all this family stuff in. And how much, when you think of it in a positive way, we can just... we can build our little families. We got grandparents here and their children and their grandchildren. And to think, what are you building in your family? What's the family culture? Because there's a family culture that one day you'll be the ancient of that family when they look back and think of the family culture that you created. And I think of men like the Rechabites who were this little cell of strength in Israel who just had this particular family culture. They never really lived in towns. Now, it's okay to live in a town. There's nothing immoral living in a town. It's fine. But they said, no, we're not going to live in town because they had this little family culture that they were going to live this certain lifestyle that they might be totally focused on God. And to think that was a power. God took that boy with the ruddy cheeks, the bright cheeks, as the New English, the New English Bible says, and the bright eyes, and the ruddy cheeks. It says, and he brings him there as he turns him not just into a king of Israel, but the salvation of that whole nation, all based on the family stamp of giving, of unconditional giving, of preparedness. If things aren't working, just build that cell of strength. Private miracles start to work in that. A real fiber. That's the thing that works. And our gift will bring us to greatness. Jesse and the 10 cream cheeses. And sometimes in life, well, you wonder what you have to do. Well, basically, that's what we have to do. Just keep making cream cheeses and bundle it up in your ecclesia for the people who deserve it and the people who don't. We do that, private miracles will start to work in our life, and things in your family and things in your meeting will go to great and better places. Thanks very much.